live from New York City. It's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. It has been my pleasure over my career to do a series of conversations called Conversations with Remarkable Minds. I began my first Conversations with Remarkable Minds in 1967 at Balkan Echo Studios up on West 96th Street. And I would interview some of the most foremost thinkers in the world, Angela Davis and Pearl Buck, Norman Mailer. In any case, today we're continuing with that. My guest is Andrew Harvey. The theme, forgetting our spiritual and philosophical ancestors and the demise of spiritual and ethical discourse. If you're not familiar with Andrew, he is quite simply one of the most renowned religious scholars in the world. He is a writer and author. He has published over 30 books. And he's also the founder of the Institute of Sacred Activism, which is an international organization dedicated to inspiring people to become more involved in challenging our global crisis and commit themselves to peace and sustainability. He was born in India, studied at Oxford University. He's been a professor at Oxford, Cornell, and California Institute of Integral Studies, and he is perhaps best known for having explored all the different religions in depth, particularly Buddhism, Christianity, Hinduism, Sufism, and interpreting them in a passionate manner that preserves their meaning and significance for our postmodern times. He's received a lot of awards, including Benjamin Franklin Award. His most recent book is Turn Me to Gold, 108 translations of the Kabir. His website is andrewharvey.net. Nice to have you with us today, Andrew.
It's great to be with you, and Happy New Year, because your work gives me such deep inspiration, and your relentless pursuit of truth and justice inspires me. Thank you, Gary.
I appreciate those kind words, Andrew. Throughout history, there have been men and women who were capable of stepping outside the confines and limiting definitions of their cultures, who were then able to perceive their societies from a completely different perspective. We've called them saints or prophets or mystics or great philosophers, and like Spinoza and Eurydicles and Sophocles and Seneca. And people still turn to these great minds today and find wisdom that is still relevant, even though they have, let's say, lived thousands of years ago, like Buddha and Plato and Confucius and Pythagoras. There are thousands of others that you could name, but we inherently recognize in them something that is universal. This is what keeps them alive even today. I would call it their moral and spiritual principles, something I find completely lacking in virtually all of the world's spiritual communities as far as their body politic goes. So when people claim that they're religious in Great Britain, and you see them going to church, or in India, or in America, this is completely disconnected from true spiritual principles. And hence, their body politics is disconnected from the consequences of lacking spiritual assentive nature. So they can kill people, cause wars, and be disconnected from any feeling or any empathy or any idea that how could a spiritual person bring this suffering to another spiritual person? And even looking at nature, the hunters, people who pride themselves on holding up a dead giraffe's head or a bunch of wolves that they are killing. And I'm thinking, where are these people grounded? There's nothing spiritual about this. There's nothing humanistic. There's no universal Gaia principle at work in this person, and yet there could be. So I want to take advantage of your expertise in the history of world religions and philosophy and have you speak about the most important universal values that have been taught in the past that are most critical and urgent today. And among the many great philosophers and mystics of the past are some that you feel a message that they gave is relevant to our times and our own times. Otherwise, we're just immersed in ignorance, and our body politics is just completely septic. The forum is yours.
Well, Gary, I could not agree with you more. I am absolutely aghast at the derelict stupidity of all of the religions at the moment. Jerry Falwell, that monument of folly, said a few days ago that there was nothing that Trump could do that could ever prevent him from supporting him. Nothing? Eat a baby alive on TV? Kill a woman on Fifth Avenue? Rape a woman on CNN? Nothing? This is what Christianity has come to. And you have only to look at the excesses of Islam and at the desperate prejudices of Hinduism and at the fact that Buddhism, which has famously championed tolerance and inclusiveness, now supporting appalling and dreadful policies in Cambodia, in Burma, and in Sri Lanka. You can only see that and just despair of the religions either meeting the deep sacred needs of humanity or helping humanity to do what it has to do at this moment, which is to look at the extremity of the world crisis in all its realms and rise with one voice, one heart, one will, one mind to meet those crises with political and social change and economic transformation on every level. You go to the heart of the problem when you say that the religions have justified all manner of prejudice and intolerance and killing, and that this is getting now epidemic and deeply serious. What I've been doing in my life is to go not to the dogmas of religion, but to those in each religion who have woken up to the universal field, to the source, to the great light that is manifesting everything, and have discovered in and through that experience of awakening the core values that every human soul is essentially aligned to, and that every human being is longing for, whether they know it or not. And these core values are compassion, born out of a knowledge of interdependence with the whole of reality. Passion for justice, born out of a sense of the crippling injustice of the systems created out of ignorance. Deep peace amongst all beings, and deep concern for the creation to protect and guard it. These are the values that every human being now needs to ground their whole lives and their whole action in if the world is to have any chance of being saved from the gathering apocalyptic crises that threaten the existence of the human race and the existence of nature. What I've been trying to do is to find and love and celebrate those universal beings who may have been instructed by one religion or another, but have risen to a universal consciousness. And that's why I've spent the last 5 years devoted to the greatest of all Indian mystics, and perhaps with Rumi, the greatest poet mystic of the world, Kabir. Because Kabir, who lived in Benares in the 15th century, was an illiterate weaver born to a poor Muslim caste in a Hindu city who had a shattering awakening to this universal field and looked around at the world that he saw and saw that world plunged in gloom, despair, nihilism, ferocious consumerism, and addiction to dogma. and railed against the Hindus, railed against the Muslims, railed against all dogma, and proposed instead a direct connection with the One leading to just action on every level. One of the things that I love most about Kabir, you also touched on, and that is our appalling treatment of animals, our appalling neglect of our interdependence with the creation, our appalling lack of understanding that the whole animal race is as sacred and as beautiful and as worthy of respect and protection as we are. Kabir was absolute backed, and that's the only word I can use, absolutely backed by all of the pretensions to holiness that both the Muslim imams and the Hindus went on about, and the killing that they allowed of hundreds of animals. And now we're in a world where there are 56 billion animals being slaughtered every year, where the species of so many species are now threatened by extinction. We have not progressed. But I believe, and continue to believe, that by bringing back these timeless universal voices, I spent 35 years recreating, translating, and speaking about Rumi as part of the great Rumi Renaissance that has happened. And now I believe Kabir's incisive, ferocious, extremely radical voice is necessary for our transformation. By bringing back these timeless voices, I am offering to humanity at this moment a way through. The source is real. God is real. The light is real. The values I've mentioned are real. There's a direct connection with the divine beyond dogma that is real. But what's most essential now is what Kabir stresses again and again and again and again with a ferocity that is matched in human history only by Jesus. What he stresses is that you do not have any worthwhile realization. You do not have anything like enlightenment until you know two things that are interconnected. Until you know in the cells of your body that you are one with the whole creation, one with every single animal and flea and stone and human being, gay, straight, black, white, yellow, purple. And until you dedicate that knowledge born out of love and adoration of the One to acting justly, calmly, fiercely, courageously on every level to protect the creation, to protect the poor, and to bring about a massive transformation in society so that the structures of cold evil can be destroyed and a world increasingly in tune with those values be created. You're so right when you say, when you look around, that you are in despair at the various religions and at the idiotic movements of the New Age that go on and on about love and light and absolutely neglect the shadow and never speak of justice. This is not spirituality. This is decadence. The real spirituality is love of God and love of neighbor and love of justice, all being three facets of the same mysterious love that creates the universe. And that's why, for me, Kabir is one of those voices that reaches out across all divisions to the human race awake and say, get directly now in contact with the One. Know that divine consciousness lives in you and in everything. Be humble, be awake, and dedicate the resources and gifts of your life to being a warrior midwife of a new world. Otherwise, you're just a fake.
I appreciate your passion and your insight. But putting aside the variety of different world cosmologies and metaphysics, humans, at least in my opinion, have not really changed that much for thousands of years. I can see in Trump the same illness that you could have seen in Nero, the Roman despot.
Exactly. Or Caligula.
Yes, the even more so Caligula. The zealots of evangelical Christianity that you just mentioned, Billy Graham's son and Jerry Falwell's son, and are not so different than the henchmen during the Inquisition, which was over a 600-year period, starting in the 12th. Patterns repeat themselves throughout history. Therefore, we seem to incarnate the same psychological and sociological pathologies over and over again, although the causes may differ from one era to another. So are there universal pathologies? You talked about the New Ages, which I have nothing to do with, because they're not dealing in a balanced look at life. They only want to see some metaphysical, ethereal euphoria always embraced, but never acknowledged the dark side of the human condition, which is always present and mirroring us. So what do you observe as some of the overriding universal pathologies being played out in our own civilization?
I think the Buddha went to the core of this side of reality when he said in the fire sermon, the world is burning to death in the fires of greed, ignorance, and craving. It's a very ferocious list, and it covers the waterfront. Greed of all kinds, born out of panic and terror. Ignorance of the nature of reality and of its laws of compassion and truth and justice, and craving, an incessant hunger to fill an incessant emptiness. I also think that Jesus went to the core of this desperation when he said in the Gospel of Thomas, if you do not bring forth what is in you, it will destroy you. Meaning at the deepest level, if you do not realize your universal connection with the source and with reality, and if you do not realize that you are a hologram of the universe, and if you do not realize that your essential self is divine and connected through that realization with absolutely everything, then you will live a narrow, panic-stricken, greedy, craving, ignorant life that will make you a slave to all the dark devils of human nature. I think, though, that in our time, we have created a terrible demonic masterpiece that encourages these dark demons of human nature. Other cultures have established rickety and not always successful, but sometimes very inspiring structures, sacred structures, that provided bulwarks and provided ways out from this dark nature. We've had periods in civilization, and Gibbons in The Decline and Fall said that the reign of Marcus Aurelius was one of them. We can think of times in the 17th century, we can times even in the 19th century at the beginning, when there have been present beings both in art and literature and in politics who have managed to create inspiring visions that led people forward. But in our time, we have all of the different systems of the planet in the control of dark, destructive forces that think of life as completely meaningless and think of life as just a playing field for winning in the darkest sense. Trump incarnates this nihilism, but it has boiled at the heart of American history and is now erupting everywhere. So this time is, in many ways, I think, the worst time that humanity has ever faced, because all of the values, if you can call them values, of the culture are values that feed that ignorance, craving, and greed, and celebrate it, and honor it, and reward it, so that those of us who are trying to live to the universal values feel enormously discouraged and disheartened, are not listened to, are not taken seriously, and have very little effect on the populace at large, who are basically kept enslaved by a system that degrades them spiritually, degrades them emotionally, renders their soul veiled and obscured, and gives very little inspiring example on any level. This is a potentially terminal situation, because we're facing the most extreme crisis of our evolution, the complete collapse of the climate, in a state of moral, spiritual, political, and economic dereliction. The human race has never been more inwardly destroyed at the very moment when it's facing a crisis that may by now be so extreme that there is very little hope that the world will not collapse within 10 to 15 years. This is a terrifying prospect. The latest report by the IPCC gave the human race 12 years to make absolutely major radical changes or be plunged into cataclysmic climate change. The Kogis, the tribe of Colombia, that is perhaps the wisest group of people on the planet. They live in the Sierra Madre and through their deep inner spiritual techniques are able to know what's happening all over the world, have said that we may only have 7 years. And I've been speaking to people at NASA recently who say quite honestly that even the extremity of the IPCC report is nothing compared to the information that they have and that is being kept from the public, because the authorities believe that if the public heard what is in those reports, they would start rioting in the streets and burning things down. This is a frightening situation on every level, and it's a devastating comment on how the human race has been strip-mined of its dignity and purpose and lust for meaning and passion for truth and justice at the very moment when it needs to bring all of those things together to be able to have a hope in heaven or hell of rising to meet the challenges before us. And they're not just challenges of climate change, the challenges that are inherent in the disgusting, obscene, exploitative, dominator economics that we have celebrated out of our greed, craving, and ignorance. They're also, as we've said, challenges that arise out of the extreme limitations of the religious systems that claim to have, each one of them in different ways, exclusive roads to the truth, which is absolute horse manure, as all of the great universal mystical teachers have known. So it's a desolate situation, but I still believe that there is, if not a way through, because we may be facing extinction, at least a way to face what we'll have to face with calm and dignity and mutual help and compassion for all life, not just human life, but animal life and the creation. And that's the way that I've been exploring in my recent books. I wrote a book called Savage Grace with Carolyn Baker, in which I laid out very clearly the crisis as I see it and as Carolyn sees it, very clearly the vision of Kali Yuga that the Hindus have given us, which was explained to me by one of its profound guardians in Benares, who said that we are now in the last but one stage, the severe stage, before it becomes the lethal and terminal stage, and that if we don't rouse ourselves, we will die out.
Andrew, but there, I'd like to address some of the things you just said.
Please.
I want to bring several different strands that seem disconnected together and see if it makes sense to you, all right? And it'll just take me a few moments, because recently I've been thinking about how our modern civilization's materialistic and reductionist worldview conditions our actions. Absolutely. And this worldview or mindset is remarkably limited and falls far below what we know about the world as the way it actually is. For example,
we
speak of holistic thinking, but as a civilization, we are extraordinarily linear. Yes. Yet holistic thinking is perfectly in line with modern science and systems theory. It simply means having the ability to see the deeper interconnections and cause and effects of how we think and what we do, both individually and collectively as governments and societies, even corporations. And perhaps the best example, as you mentioned, is climate change. And it's not simply that the Earth is getting warmer because of greenhouse gas emissions. Rather, it is our entire way of life, what we eat, how we acquire our food, how we entertain ourselves, how we live and develop in our cities and towns, how we move about and transport ourselves, careers and work, how we keep ourselves warm in winter and cool in summer. All of these are habits and patterns of ritualized dogmatic behavior that are in intricately related to the cause and effect behind climate change and upon us. And then I ask, how do we understand holistic thinking, and what might be some of the steps and exercises people can adapt in order to get out of the rut of linear thinking and to witness the deeper interrelationships between ourselves and each other, and also our historical wise men and women who said, before you go pell-mell into something, stop and ask, what do you expect as the outcome? What are you willing to accept as a consequence of your actions and your deeds and your thoughts? And that led me, that's one strand. But then that led me to a different one, and one that is very pragmatic and one that is rarely considered. And I ended up giving this a term, for better or worse, and the term is intentional neglect and intentional ignorance.
Yes.
Meaning that we have people running religions, like in Saudi Arabia, that completely promotes through its madrasas, its religious schools all around the world, but especially at the Iranian and Iraqi borders, a form of Sunniism, Wahhabism, that is so radical it cannot live in balance with any other religion. And therefore, it is completely intolerant of all other religions, all other beliefs, and therefore, whatever it chooses to do to a person who is simply living their lives is no longer acceptable. You must live your life in accordance to its particular principles, or you're considered the other. And we see what it has done in Yemen to the other, what it has done in supporting terrorist groups like al-Nusra and al-Qaeda throughout the Middle East, what it has done in supporting with Israel, another one of the monotheistic areas of the world where it thinks only of its own interests, not how it relates to the well-being of others. Look at the Palestinians as an example. And yet you will find people calling themselves hyper-religious, ultra-religious, ultra-orthodox religious, but acting without any spiritual values whatsoever. And then we come back to the United States. So that's the second strand. What we call ourselves, how we define ourselves, may have nothing to do with the reality of the larger universe we live in. It only has to do with our own individual truths without any respect for universal truths, as if somehow we're disconnected from universal environmental laws. What happens in the Arctic, Antarctic, Greenland, what happens in the high desert plains and high Alps is irrelevant to us. What happens in the Sahara Desert, the acidification of the ocean, the bleaching of the coral reef is irrelevant to us. What happens in the lower delta, the Mississippi, what happens to industrial runoff, what happens to phosphate fertilizers causing dead zones the size of New Jersey in 400 locations, what happens to the garbage patch of plastic in the Pacific, which is now three times the size of France, is irrelevant to us. What happens to a tornado in Oklahoma, to a flood in Houston, to a fire in both Oregon and Montana and in California is irrelevant to us. And so the world around us is completely irrelevant. It is only what is happening in this moment, in this hour, in this second, into the rituals of what we're doing. And we refuse by intentional neglect to know the damage done by vaccines and lack of science and the entire fraud of our public health system. We refuse to accept that our doctor is not a high priest with connection directly to a higher being and therefore can heal us. We refuse to look at the limitations in our body politic that was sold out long ago for corporate sponsorship and the fact that we actually allow oligarchs to control who is selected and therefore given to us is who we must elect from who they've selected. So no matter who we elect, it's always someone they've selected. We forget through intentional ignorance that there's cause and effect of what we eat, we become, what we think, we become, what we breathe, we become, what we feel, we become. And therefore, why not choose something that is to the harmonizing higher level of all consciousness? We say that we are fully employed and we believe it at 3.8%. Yet I'm looking at figures every day and the official unemployment rate, unemployed, those out of job, is 5,902,225. But the actual unemployment, they say, is actually 12 million.
Yeah.
They say it's 12,303,000. But I look at 130,000 full-time workers. I'm looking at 27,000 part-time workers. But here's a figure they don't use. 95,996,000.
That's
people
it.
In the United States who are not in the labor force and therefore excluded from
right.
any discussion. Therefore, we're about 27% actual unemployed. That's like saying those of us who believe in this religion, those of us practicing these principles, are the core of all truth, and you're excluding everyone like yourself and all that you said. We're excluded from conversation, from being in any of the forums, and therefore you only have the ultra, ultra true believers having any passion for a discourse. I'm looking at a country that acknowledges 71,968,464,000,000 dollars in debt, but then turns around and says, oh, and by the way, we also have unfunded liabilities of $122,055,000,000 and with medical liability of $29,234,000,000,000, Social Security at $19 trillion. Well, how's Social Security liability? We paid into it. The government didn't pay a penny into it. And they say, well, we've been borrowing all of your Social Security this whole time. Well, how can you borrow something from us, use it for wars, and then say somehow it's an entitlement to us? You've never given us a penny. And yet the average person is disconnected by this reality and suggesting that if the government decides, which it is and will, to cut back our Social Security, which is a feeble way of dealing with people who have real needs in their senior years, we're saying make do with $700 a month. And you say, but I have to pay my mortgage or my rent, my utilities. I have to buy food. I have to transport myself. I have to pay for a telephone. How can I do that on $700? And the government says, we are indifferent. It is not our problem. Well, hold on. Didn't the person who say that their child is obese and the child has diabetes and the child has heart disease because they're feeding them junk food and then wanting it to be paid for and blame someone else for this instead of taking responsibility? Isn't this the same mindset? It is the same mindset, except one can afford to feed themselves into obesity, the other can't. And did they both end up at the same place, like the Italian proverb, both the king and the peasant go in the same dirt? So I'm looking at nothing but a living in a bubble of deception. Our educational systems do not educate how to think critically and challenge the system itself. We have pampered, and obedient to their own needs children who don't want to be taught, who are living in this snowflake bubble. Anything that you say that might cause them to think critically, they find offensive and run into a room where they're hugged by a group of people paid for to accept that it is a legitimate crisis in them when it's not. Do you want leaders who cannot take the truth? Then all they're going to do is look for the deception that they can be comfortable with. Our body politics is nothing but deception. We're talking about what's going on at the border 100% of the time, every second, every day, and not looking at how many children are food insecure who don't have enough food to eat today, 17 million. How many Americans living on $2 a day, 3 million. How many children are living with no home and they have to live wherever they can go into a shelter or a car or a van at night or couch surf, 2.3 million. Why aren't their needs important? Because if you were really spiritual and living by the principles of Maimonides and Montaigne, you would care about those people. But we don't care about those people. Like we don't care about what happens when there is a tsunami in the largest typhoon also in Indonesia, in the Philippines, just 3 weeks ago. We don't care about Fukushima, still active after 7 years and still producing over 100,000 gallons of polluted water each day. We don't care about anything except what goes on in our own life. So therefore, we cannot care about the world. You say, but we will be saved by the best and enlightened, the most educated, the most successful, the careerist. And we have 71 million careerists. When you add in their family, even going from four down to three family members, you're still dealing with a huge number of people. Just do the math. If you have 71 million people who are lawyers, accountants, engineers, teachers, medical doctors, CPAs, architects, people with advanced degrees or higher education, and you got 71 million, you're dealing with 213 million people. And including also the 10 million millionaires, now you're up to about 270 million people who are living very affluent lives. 10 million of those people can afford it with their children, 30 million. So they can afford the private schools, and they could afford the lifestyle they want, and they want a lifestyle that they want their muscle-rubbed Colby beef that is fed beer so it can have a special flavor, and they'll pay, you know, $60 a pound for it. They want their children to be able to go to a bar at night and buy designer brewer beer at $50 a glass and be able to drink four glasses a night. Now, the doctor and the lawyer, they don't make the same money. They're not that rich, but they want to live like they are. So their kids are going to the same private schools. They're going on the same private jets. They're still living the same lifestyle. They're buying stuff they don't need. They're eating food that's toxic and dangerous. And yet they will say, do you want global warming? No, I don't. Do you care about animals? Yes, I do. Well, then why did you and your kids go on a safari and shoot a bunch of caged lions that were harmless in South Africa to a corrupt government? All of the governments are now corrupt, so that Absolutely. You could take a picture with a lion that meant you no harm, and you as a coward and you as a narcissist are now holding a picture to be prided in the community that you live with by taking out a real lion from a pride and upsetting the nature balance and decimating and making extinct. These are doctors, lawyers, engineers, architects, children, or themselves. We have all these people in the United States claiming they care, and I don't see a goddamn one doing anything, especially on the left, especially on the right, especially the conservatives, especially the liberals. Everybody claims by their ideological reference points in their moniker that they're unique and special and they care and they should be listened to, and I don't see them doing a damn thing to help the world. I don't see them sacrificing. I see it. I see the supercilious nature of what should have given us a big red flag saying the snowflakes are coming at the movement down on Wall Street of Occupy Wall Street. I went down there. I was there 22 days until Michael Moore found out that he gets some more free publicity and buy himself another meal with it. And he shows up. Why does he show up? Why doesn't he go out there and do something? You have the money, Michael. Build a camp for homeless people. Go in the communities, not because there's a TV camera crew there, but actually do something from humility. And let's see the difference. We have celebrities who say they're against walls. Okay, fine, be against a wall. Then take down the wall around your house. You're against guns. Then disarm your armed bodyguards, 500 of them at the Academy Awards. The hypocrisy is palpable at every level. And this is intentional neglect from intentional lack of spiritual connection, from intentional ignorance. And yet we say, you mean smoking's bad, drinking's bad, eating meat's bad, eating sugar's bad, not buying clothes we don't need, that is bad. You mean traveling and not traveling in different ways. And I'm saying, you mean I have to tell you this? Yeah, I didn't know. So now we have a whole nation that just wants more information. So now, no matter how much information through the internet you cipher into their vacuous, empty skulls, no matter what their degree, no matter what their position, from tenured professors to think tank directors, from heads of agencies to doctoral offices, they're all filled with this giant void. the void of true compassion, true sensitivity, true spirituality, true humanistic values, true principles of universal cause and effect. Now, you put all this together, and then who exactly is supposed to lead us out of the wilderness of our massive consumption, narcissistic indulgences, pornographic emotions? Are these supposed to be the people who are not going to change anything personally but expect you to do it, or not going to fight the battle against corruption and malfeasance within every corpuscle of the body politic, but you're supposed to do it, who are not going to allow their children to learn the real arts and crafts of life and to take advantage of technical schools and craft schools and learn to be plumbers and electricians and masons instead of going to Harvard to learn nothing except how to be another greedy little degenerate bastard going to Wall Street, as if they're any other than that there, or another godforsaken neurosurgeon who's going to figure out how to make $2 million instead of $1 million a year. And are these the people supposed to lead us when they can't lead themselves in one single moment of their lives in the right direction? And are those working class people and the unworking class people who are feeding themselves into an early grave and their children going with them, they're supposed to suddenly develop a consciousness to realize there's a consciousness alive in an animal and therefore it is a sacred sentient being? Those are my thoughts. I'd like yours.
Gary, you have just given the most clear picture of our apocalyptic situation that I have ever heard. And every word that you have said rings absolutely true to me. I know that what you've described is totally real. This has been prophesied in all of the great secret mystical traditions, and I've made a personal study of it, and what they have said, the Hindus say in their vision of Kali Yuga, the Sufi mystics in their vision of the potential end of the planet, the Christian mystics in their understanding of the end times as being a kind of demonic Pentecost in which all values are destroyed. What they have said points exactly in every detail to what you have said. So what does this mean? What this means is what Kabir, who understood this, says in this poem, and I'm reading this to you, Gary. Lord, a fire's blazing without any fuel. No one knows how to put it out. I know it spreads from you, burning the whole world. Even in water, the flames erupt. Not one, but nine streams burn. No one has protection. As the city burns down, the watchman sleeps smugly, thinking my house is safe. Let the city blaze, so long as my things are saved. How can anyone's desires be slaked in a hunchback's arms? You think on this, you say, but stagger from birth to birth, your body and your heart and your soul and your mind forever unillumined. No one is as stupid as the one who knows this and pretends not to. Kabir asks, what way out could there be for such a fool? That was written in the 15th century by someone who knew exactly where the human race that he saw in squalor around him was going, and it has arrived at that place. And it is the end of civilization, and where there is no healing from within this culture, of this culture. There are now only two possible scenarios before the human race, and you and I both know this. There is a scenario in which we pursue this mad, depraved addiction to power and narcissism and consumerism on every level with no heart, no conscience, and that will result in our extinction and taking with us a great deal of nature. The other scenario is not much more hopeful, because this culture, this civilization you're describing, is doomed from within and without and is going to collapse and will take, in its collapse, billions of people. The Kogis say maybe 7 billion people will die, and other indigenous people who know what life truly is and the interconnection of all life and what the values of compassion and humility and service and simplicity truly are, they say sometimes that there will only be remnants living in very degraded pockets. This is what the human race is facing. what I am trying to do with my work are three things. I'm trying to model, as you're trying to model, the outrage and the truth and the humility and the passion for service and the passion to wake people up with my own words, but also with my own life. That's the first thing I'm trying to do. The second thing I'm trying to do is to keep hoping against hope or beyond hope that we won't become extinct totally, but that there will be a remnant, and that that remnant will need some memory of some people who stood up in this world, in this depraved, disgusting, obscene culture, and really tried to model the ancient and timeless values, and really tried to give both as clear a picture of the depravity and as rich and deep a picture of what life is like when it's lived from the soul and in the heart with a passion for justice. And the third thing that I'm trying to do, and this is something that I know you are trying to do in your own way with your magnificent outrage and clarity, is to give to that remnant, if there will be a remnant, a map of how to put divine wisdom, divine love into action, because they're going to need that map, because if any of us survive, we will be so traumatized by what has happened, so devastated by what we have to survive in a devastated, degraded planet, that we are going to need all of the spiritual inspiration, all of the nobility and dignity modeled for us that we can possibly have. So that's my position. I'm absolutely in agreement with what you've said. I cannot for a moment believe that this culture is going to be transformed and reform itself and dissolve its structures of cold evil. I don't see that anywhere. This culture is doomed. We're just waiting for the collapse. What we don't know is whether this collapse will take the whole human race with it, and what we don't know is whether there'll be anybody left afterwards. What we can be absolutely damn sure of, though, is that if there are remnants left, they will be in terrible circumstances. So I'm hoping against hope and beyond hope that what I do and what the people like you and I and others on the earth who are, there are others doing absolutely heroic, humble, selfless, passionate work from the deepest place of outrage and humility and love. And I hope that their examples and their words and their visions will somehow survive the apocalypse that's coming to inspire the regeneration of the human race. But it's a hope that's growing ever more threadbare. But what I would say to people who are listening to this is this. There is a way, even in this apocalyptic, disgusting situation that could become terminal, to stay centered and humble and devoted and dedicated to serving others and the whole creation in your own life. And that is by undergoing a massive inner transformation, very sincerely, very committedly, very fast, and trying as best you can to do the best you can in a dignified way. Chris Hedges has written brilliantly of the need for sheer defiance as a way of staying human. Your defiance keeps you human, Gary. I hope my defiance keeps me human. But our defiance isn't simply petulant or enraged outrage. It is grounded in a living experience of the unity of the whole creation. It's grounded in a living, cellular, passionate, heartfelt, soul-filled experience of love. It's grounded in a passion for universal justice for all beings, and it's grounded in a deep understanding that the divine is real for all of the horrors of the religions. The great mystical systems have preserved this knowledge of divine identity. So what I'm saying to people is this. Whatever happens, there are four ways that you can stay defiant, dignified, way you want it. It doesn't matter whether you're a Buddhist or a Hindu, or that is all rubbish. You've got to have a direct connection beyond concept and dogma, and there are simple techniques to do so. The saying of the name of God, meditation, and over time they will reveal to you that something much larger than you is living in you as you. The second way is to, as long as nature exists, to see that you're in as constant and reverential a connection with nature as possible. The third way is to really choose to love and honor all beings with your resources, with your gifts, and serve them in whatever way you can with your essential gifts. You serve with this unrelenting passion for truth-telling that you have perfected. I serve with my own traveling around the world in my late 60s with my back broken. And the fourth way is to really make a commitment, whatever arises, to act, to keep acting. The problem for most people, and it's not just intentional ignorance, which is terrifying enough, the problem for most people is that they cannot conceive of a form of action that is not going to have spectacular results. And we are being summoned potentially to keep acting from compassion and justice and unity, even in terminal conditions, which couldn't possibly have any profitable results. But if you go deep into yourself, you will find the deathless living in you. If you go deep into yourself, you'll find a kind of adamantine courage that defeat after defeat after defeat will never destroy. And it's from that place, that self, that deep divine human truth, that we still can live lives of meaning in a collapsing, meaningless, apocalyptic, burning world. That's what I'm saying. And that's what I'm living. And that's what I know is possible. And that's why I'm devoting myself to getting this vision of sacred activism out, not in any triumphal way and not with any sense that if you do this, everything will be okay. It's not going to be okay. It's going to be terrible and maybe terminal. But because I know that if you can stay grounded in the self, and if you can connect with nature and be resilient and be kind and be compassionate, whatever happens, your life will have joy and truth. I'm reminded of something that I think about a lot, and I know you probably know this and of all of other examples, but one of my favorite 20th century people, a great hero of the soul, is a woman called Etty Hillerson, who consciously joined her Jewish family, although she'd converted to Christianity, to go to the camps. And on the way to the camps, she threw her diary out of the window, and it was found and published, and it's been one of the most extraordinary inspirations to me. It's an absolutely amazing document. And the last line in the diary is, "Remember, when you think of me and us, that we went to the camps singing. I am not, and you are not, going to allow the last triumph of this darkness, which is to destroy inner joy born for no reason out of a direct relation with reality. I am not, and you are not, going to allow the conscienceless of a depraved age to destroy our compassion. I am not, and you are not, going to allow the utter selfishness and narcissism of the whole shebang of the powerful and the so-called religious and the New Age to divert us from what we know is the truth, that the truth of service born out of a passion for compassion and justice for all life. And if it comes to everything being destroyed, I want it to be said of me, not by anybody who survives, because there'll be nobody who survives, but said of me by myself, to myself, that I went to that destruction, singing the praise of the divine and acting with the whole dignity and the whole passion of my being to represent true human divine being, come what may." That is, I think, for me, the truth of what I am trying and failing often, but passionately engaging myself in order to live. And that's what I think you so nobly stand for and so fiercely stand for. And I hope everybody listening to this will not use the excuse of the very dark analysis that we've made to sign off from the absolute imperative that has been stressed by you, by me, by Chris Hedges, by all of the thinkers and feelers and philosophers and mystics who know our situation, from really engaging with a deep inner journey and really putting love into action. If we are going to be in a hospice, we're going to have to be the nurses at that hospice. And if we're going to be in a dying world, we're going to have to be people who represent the values of life. And that's it. And that's how the cookie crumbles. And that's what we're facing. And that's what I'm giving everything I'm doing and everything I'm saying to trying to inspire people to do. I'm not in
Andrew,
any way optimistic.
I do have some optimism because I see more and more people, younger and older, coming to an awareness that the existing paradigm has no exits for them and no happy future. So they're looking for that which is more spiritual and grounded in what we as individuals working collectively together in intentional communities can do. And I see that as a very, very positive future. Andrew Harvey,
well,
we're out of time. Thank you very much.
A positive alignment, but in the actual facts of climate collapse, we can't talk about
it's going
future,
to collapse.
But what we can talk of alignment. Yes, I agree with you, and those are the people I am trying to reinforce and help and sustain because they are going
Good
to carry the truth ahead.
And even with climate change, I'm finishing a major documentary on climate change, and I believe that there are those of us who can prepare and are, who are not nihilists, and looking towards being more sustainable. So that will be another discussion. So where the climate is collapsing, and we've tipped on at least 9 of the tipping points that will,
exactly,
nothing we do will change, but there's still a possibility for a future of quality of life if we know what we're doing. We're out of time, Andrew. Thank you very much for being with us.
And thank you, dear Gary. God bless you.
Andrew Harvey. And by the way, unless I'm mistaken, Andrew was the youngest professor at Oxford University. Andrew's book is, and write it down, please, Turn Me to Gold, 108 Translations of Kebir. And his website is andrewharvey.net. Thank you all for listening. This has been Conversations with Remarkable Minds. Have a nice day.